content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the January 16th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. The GOP gets its chance. What happened? Republicans formally took control of both chambers of Congress for the first time in 8 years this week and pledged to push through an ambitious legislative agenda. But internal party divisions and a threat of veto by President Obama highlighted the limit of the party's new power. As new members of Congress were sworn in, GOP leaders announced they would quickly hold votes on approving the long-delayed Keystone XL pipeline, which would transport Canadian tar sands oil to the Gulf Coast, and changing the definition of full-time work in the president's health care law from 30 hours to 40, thus reducing the number of workers whom employers would be compelled to insure. New Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he hoped the legislative push would show voters that the GOP could offer a responsible, right-of-center governing majority. Obama said this week that he will veto the planned Keystone and Affordable Care Act legislation. In the House, John Boehner had to fight off insurrection by a small but influential group of Tea Party conservatives who challenged his leadership. He was successfully elected to a third term as Speaker with 216 votes. But 25 GOP representatives voted against Boehner, the largest rebellion by a party against its incumbent Speaker since the Civil War. What the editorial said: "There's a refreshed sense of possibility in Washington," said the Wall Street Journal. "The leaders of the GOP's new center-right majority are eager to prove they can push the country in a conservative direction, but with Obama in the White House, they can't try to do too much, such as defunding Obamacare. They should modestly focus on economic growth, regulatory restraint, and corporate tax reform to show how they'd govern if given the keys to the White House in 2016. The danger is that Republicans will try to do too much, then break down in disunity, and thus set up Obama to hand off the presidency to Hillary Clinton. There are many areas where moderate Democrats and Republicans could find common ground," said the Baltimore Sun. "They could pass long-overdue bills that would strengthen cybersecurity, repair crumbling infrastructure, or close special interest tax loopholes so that the corporate tax rate can be lowered in a revenue-neutral manner. That would show Republicans are serious about leading the country, not just currying the favor with the Fox News and talk radio crowd." What the columnist said: "McConnell might claim that Republicans are now the party of responsible governance," said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. "Yet the GOP's agenda is still defined largely around opposition to Obama. Republicans know the president won't allow his signature health care law to be undermined or Keystone to be approved until the State Department finishes its review of the project. But GOP leaders are intent on advancing these dead-in-the-water ideas because their increasingly rebellious conservative base demands maximum confrontation. Actually, it's Obama who's the obstacle to bipartisan compromise," said Fred Barnes in the Wall Street Journal. "He is a clumsy negotiator. In 2011, he wrecked a $4 trillion agreement on raising taxes and slashing spending by demanding more in taxes at the last minute. That same year, a deal on increasing the spending limit remained out of reach until Vice President Joe Biden stepped in and arranged a compromise with McConnell. The president is unlikely to reach across the aisle anytime soon," said Zach Coleman in WashingtonExaminer.com. He made his threat to veto Keystone legislation within hours of Congress's convening, proving that he's more concerned about satisfying an environmental base than getting out of the way a project most Americans support. The American people are tired of legislative gridlock and political infighting, said Donald Lambro in the Washington Times. They want to see the president and Congress get things done. With 54 Republicans in the Senate, McConnell needs the support of just 6 Democrats to get bills sent to the president's desk. When the 2016 election comes around, a stack of vetoed legislation could be one of the GOP's best tools to woo voters, fed up with a do-nothing president and ready for change. As a second main story, we have terrorist massacre in Paris. A dozen people were killed and 11 injured this week when 3 Kalashnikov-wielding Islamic extremists stormed the Paris office of satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and gunned down the publication's editor-in-chief, 4 cartoonists, and other employees. 2 police officers were also killed. As the week went to press, a huge manhunt was underway for the masked gunmen, who told witnesses they were acting for Al-Qaeda in Yemen and shouted, "Allahu Akbar," as they carried out their attack. More than 500 riot and national police were deployed across Paris to search for the assailants, identified as French-born brothers Saïd Kaouchi, 34, and Sherif Kaouchi, 32, and a third man, Hamed Mourad, 18. Known for its history of satirizing radical Islam, Charlie Hebdo had previously been the target of a 2011 firebombing after running a cartoon depicting the Prophet Muhammad. "There is no barbaric act that will ever extinguish the freedom of the press," said French President François Hollande in response to the attacks. "Responsibility for this week's tragedy lies with those barbaric gunmen who butchered the innocent," said Andrew Studdiford in NationalReview.com. "But I can't help thinking liberals across the West encourage this attack, having peddled the dangerous idea that, when it comes to Islam, certain things must not be written, said, or shown. Instead, they should have followed the brave example of the murdered Charlie Hebdo editor, Stéphane Charbonnier, who declared 2 years ago, 'I'd rather die standing than live on my knees.'" "This horrific attempt to suppress free speech is a challenge to Europe's identity," said Michael Rubin in CommentaryMagazine.com. "Citizenship is a compact and should be bestowed only on those who accept the supremacy of the values around which the nation is organized. In France and Europe at large, free expression and individual freedom trump anyone's religious sensibilities. It's long past time for Europeans to stop timidly tiptoeing around Islamic intolerance and radicalism." "This is a dangerous moment for France," said Amy Davidson in NewYorker.com. "Large parts of Europe are currently in rebellion against Muslim immigrants. The temptation for the French, after this week's tragedy, will be to look to extremists like Marine Le Pen, the leader of the far-right National Front, for solutions. Let's hope someone is ready to come forward with other, better answers." Our controversy of the week, Obamacare. Why, in year 2, it's still so unpopular? To understand why President Obama's Affordable Care Act is so unpopular one full rocky year after its implementation, consider Amanda Mayhew, 38, of Kentucky, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Mayhew told an interviewer last week that the ACA's expansion of the Medicaid system enabled her to get long overdue treatment for dental problems, depression, and a suspicious skin mole, for which she is very, very thankful. But Mayhew, a 38-year-old mother of four, also says, "I don't love Obamacare," saying the law has things in it that scare me, citing news program reports that the ACA prohibits life-saving treatment to elderly cancer patients. That's completely not true, but it's a testimony to how effectively Republicans have damaged the program with outright falsehoods. When the ACA passed, Obama and his supporters thought they could declare victory and move on, said Joanne Kinnan in Politico.com. But by failing so dismally to explain the program to the public, Obamacare's architects and advocates left the job half undone. No law that 58% of voters now say they want to repeal can be considered a success. Obamacare's foes may have won the public relations struggle, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But in the real world, the ACA is working extremely, even shockingly well. At least 10 million previously uninsured Americans have gained coverage in the last year. The national uninsured rate has fallen 30%. New enrollments are surging for year two, and the Act's market-based cost-controlled mechanisms appear to be working. Insurance premiums that conservatives insisted would soar have risen an average of only 2%, and overall health care costs rose more slowly in 2014 than at any time over the last half century. Don't be fooled. The real pain starts this year, said David Catron in Spectator.org. The ACA was cunningly designed to delay its most odious features, including the employer mandate, which now kicks in. The mandate, requiring generous health care coverage for anyone working 30 or more hours a week, burdens companies with higher costs that will be passed on to employees in the form of higher premiums and deductibles. The ACA also faces a backlash from primary care doctors it has overloaded with new Medicaid patients. The coming year will be the ACA's worst yet, said Tevi Troy in CommentaryMagazine.com. Congress will keep chiseling away at the law, and a GOP-backed legal challenge may result in the Supreme Court's eliminating subsidies to people in 34 states who obtain their insurance through federally run exchanges. If that happens, the ACA will implode. Republicans should be careful what they wish for, said Leo Girard in HuffingtonPost.com. Instead of trying to improve the ACA, the GOP is on a mission to destroy the program without having anything to replace it. If Republicans succeed legislatively or in the Supreme Court, they will take away a basic necessity, health care, from more than 10 million Americans and cause widespread suffering. Do they really think such heartlessness is a winning strategy? The truth, said Jonathan Bernstein in BloombergView.com, is that when pollsters ask for opinions about Obamacare, most of us just project our feelings about the president onto the program. Ask people about the law's individual components, and it's far more popular. If Republicans take away affordable health coverage from people with pre-existing conditions or self-employed businessmen and women, the polls might change. Well, it was a good week for small miracles after a UK man paid $465 for life-saving surgery for his constipated goldfish. The actual surgery is quite straightforward, said the vet. Administering the anesthetic is quite complicated. It was a good week for low expectations after a Pew Research Center survey of 48,643 people in 44 countries found that people in poorer nations in Africa and South America were more likely to say they were having a good day than people in Europe, Asia, or even the U.S. And it was a good week for bad publicity after Sony Pictures announced that it had earned $31 million through online and on-demand sales of The Interview, the most lucrative digital release of a Hollywood film in history. It was a bad week for Harvard University's faculty, which reacted in outrage when the university announced that partly as a result of Affordable Care Act reforms, they will have to share more of the cost of their very generous health care coverage. It's equivalent to taxing the sick, complained one professor. It was a bad week for Custom Publishing after HarperCollins failed to identify Israel in its New World Atlas geared for the Middle Eastern market. The omission, the publisher said, was a response to local preferences. And it was a bad week for Double Jeopardy after a Chicago man's bicycle was stolen from a police station while he was there reporting the theft of his iPhone. I told the officer I would like to file another police report, victim Adam Wisniewski said. He said, okay, you don't have to tell me what happened. On the briefing page, Cuba and Uncle Sam. The U.S. and Cuba, which are now resuming diplomatic relations, have always had a tangled relationship. When did Cuba become a nation? It won its independence from Spain at the end of the 19th century, but only because of U.S. intervention. In the 1898 Spanish-American War, the U.S. supported the Cuban rebels who had been struggling for independence for years, and the powerful U.S. military drove the Spaniards out. But the help came with a price. After a brief occupation, the U.S. recognized an independent Cuban government but maintained a naval base at Guantanamo Bay and forbade Cuba from making treaties with other countries. American dollars poured in and the American corporations snapped up sugar plantations. In the 1930s, amid political turmoil, Cuban Army Sergeant Fulgencio Batista seized power in a coup with the full support of the U.S. From the 1930s to the 1950s, Cuba became a playground for wealthy Americans. Who went to Cuba? At that time, Havana was the swingingest city in the hemisphere, known as the Paris of the Americas. Snazzy casinos and hotels run by Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, and other American mob figures dotted Havana. And Hollywood stars like Ava Gardner and Marlon Brando filled them up, dancing, drinking, and going to cabarets and horse races. The U.S. Mafia and Batista essentially ran the island together. I would say Batista was an equal partner with the mobsters, said T.J. English, author of Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. The mafiosi, Meyer Lansky, Santo Traficante, couldn't have done what they did without their relationship to Fulgencio Batista. Was Batista good for Cubans? Not for most Cubans. Ruling sometimes as president and sometimes under puppet presidents, Batista ran Cuba for more than two decades as a brutal, quasi-fascist dictator. The Cuban aristocracy flourished, but most Cubans remained desperately poor. At one point in the 1940s, opposition to his rule grew so great that he moved to Florida and set up a political base there. He soon returned to Cuba to run for office, and when it became clear he would lose the 1952 election, he staged another coup. In the late 1950s, Marxist revolutionaries led by Fidel Castro and Che Guevara had launched an armed rebellion, and they took control in 1959. What did Castro do? Castro ruthlessly crushed the other resistance groups, imprisoning or executing his rivals. He angered the Cuban elite by nationalizing scores of private companies, including many U.S. subsidiaries. By 1960, the U.S., alarmed at a communist regime less than 100 miles off the Florida coast, imposed an embargo. Batista supporters and others persecuted by Castro fled en masse to Florida, where they and their descendants became a passionate political force dedicated to destroying the communist regime. The first chance came in 1961 when the CIA mobilized some 1,400 Cuban exiles to try to overthrow Castro in the Bay of Pigs invasion. President Kennedy was publicly humiliated by the invasion's abject failure. The next year, U.S. spy planes caught the Soviet Union building silos for nuclear missiles in Cuba, sparking the blockade known as the Cuban Missile Crisis. Nuclear war was narrowly averted when the Soviets turned back their ships and removed the missiles. How did Cuba fare under Castro? Under the communist government's iron-fisted control, Cuba's economy withered. The country remained desperately poor and strangely frozen in time, as flashy 50s-era Chevys with tail fins rusted on the streets and colorful mansions crumbled. Cubans had no political self-determination and no freedom of speech, and few were allowed to travel abroad. But they did have excellent free education and free health care. Castro's relationship with the U.S. remained hostile. In 1980, Castro suddenly let thousands of Cubans flee to the U.S., but he released thousands of criminals and mental patients to join them on rickety boats to Florida. What's changed? The older generation of Cuban exiles in the U.S. is dying off, and their children do not hold the same hardline views on the Castro regime. Now, 2 out of 3 Americans believe the embargo should be lifted, and most Cuban Americans do too, since isolating the regime has not caused it to collapse. In Cuba, an ailing Fidel ceded power to his brother Raul Castro in 2008 during the global economic crisis, and Raul began some modest economic reforms. Cubans can now start businesses, lease farmland, buy and sell property, and even in some cases travel abroad. Meanwhile, the drop in oil prices means Cuba can no longer rely on ally Venezuela to prop it up with oil wealth. All these factors combined to make Cuba receptive to change when President Obama began secret negotiations to exchange prisoners and restore diplomatic relations. We cannot keep doing the same thing and expect a different result, Obama said. But will the embargo be lifted? That's up to Congress. Fidel, the survivor. When Fidel Castro seized power in Havana, the CIA tried to kill him. Not once, but dozens of times. Some plots were planned but never carried out, including the famous exploding cigar. Another plot that never came to fruition was to take advantage of Castro's fondness for scuba diving by planting an exploding conch shell in his favorite diving spot. At one point, the CIA mulled putting a chemical in Castro's shoes that would make his beard fall out to cause him public humiliation. At another point, it researched ways to slip him LSD so he would have an acid trip in public and be discredited. The more serious plots simply failed. The CIA slipped poison cigars into Castro's supply during a UN trip, but either he didn't smoke them or they didn't work. An ex-lover hired to poison him didn't follow through, and spies ordered to poison his food never got close enough to try. Castro stepped down in 2008 because of illness, but his reign lasted 10 presidencies, from Dwight Eisenhower's to George W. Bush's. Take a look now at our columns. We'll take 2 from the U.S. this week. The first comes from Kevin Drum at MotherJones.com. Why has crime kept dropping? The broken windows theory of crime reduction is almost certainly wrong, said Kevin Drum. It's true that crime in New York City began a steep 2-decade decline after the police department began cracking down on vandalism, graffiti, and other petty crimes in the early 1990s. But crime rates in other major cities such as Chicago, Dallas, and Los Angeles that didn't institute broken windows policing went down at the same rate and time as in New York City. Urban crime has continued to decline steeply throughout the country, and criminologists have advanced many theories to explain this phenomenon, including the decline of lead-based paint, which can cause brain abnormalities that lead to violence. The rise of legal abortion, which kept legions of unwanted poor people from being born, and the end of the crack epidemic. New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton, who was also commissioner in the 90s, disdains such theories as far-fetched speculation by academics. But Bratton and other broken window advocates need to believe that the things they do affect crime. In fact, crime is down for multiple reasons, most of them reflecting major social changes beyond the control of the cops. And from John McWhorter at the Wall Street Journal, how English took over the world. The future belongs to the English language, said John McWhorter. English is rapidly becoming what the creators of Esperanto had envisioned, a language spoken on every continent, and the primary medium for communication among different nations. Today, almost 2 billion people speak English to some degree, and soon one of three people on Earth will be able to converse in it. Though China's population is the largest of any nations, English is far more entrenched in global technology and media than Mandarin, which is extremely difficult for non-natives to speak and write. If a century from now the Chinese rule the world, they will likely do so in English. In 2115, linguists estimate, only about 600 of the 6,000 languages now spoken around the world will remain. Major languages such as Spanish, Hindi, Arabic, and Russian will continue to be used within nations. But when Earthlings deal with the larger world online or in person, English will be the lingua franca. The passing of so many languages into antiquity is, no doubt, a shame. But universal comprehension is a powerful consolation. And this from Germany, an editorial from Nuremberger Nachrichten. Europe's to blame for ships of refugees. Don't blame the people smugglers, said Nuremberg Nachrichten. Human traffickers recently abandoned two boatloads of Syrian refugees in the Mediterranean, leaving these ghost ships to drift without crews towards certain shipwreck. The Italian Navy saved the more than 1,000 people on board by dropping sailors onto the boats from helicopters. And European Union leaders were quick to condemn the smugglers, saying they had reached a new depth of cruelty. We could say the same about the EU's asylum policy. Thanks to Brussels' harsh visa system, there is no way for war refugees to get to Europe unless they turn to the criminals. As long as the wars in Syria and Libya rage on, there will be masses of asylum seekers, and they will suffer and die trying to reach the safety of European shores. Rather than screeching about the immorality of the traffickers, the EU should do the moral thing and open up reception centers in North Africa to process asylum and refugee claims. Further, it should introduce a quota system so that each member country must accept an equal share of refugees. It is the height of hypocrisy to denounce traffickers when our own policies ensure they have plenty of business. And we turn now to the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, What Happened to Innovation? The big breakthroughs occurred from 1945 to 1971, said Michael Hanlon. Today, progress has stalled. We live in a golden age of technological, medical, scientific, and social progress. Look at our computers. Look at our phones. 20 years ago, the internet was a creaky machine for geeks. Now we can't imagine life without it. Life expectancy in some rich countries improving by 5 hours a day. A day? Surely immortality, or something very like it, is just around the corner. The notion that our 21st century world is one of accelerating advances is so dominant that it seems churlish to challenge it. Almost every week we read about new hopes for cancer sufferers, developments in the lab that might lead to new cures, talk of a new era of space tourism, and superjets that can fly around the world in a few hours. Yet a moment's thought tells us that this vision of unparalleled innovation can't be right, that many of these breathless reports of progress are in fact mere hype, speculation, even fantasy. Yet there once was an age when speculation matched reality. It spluttered to a halt more than 40 years ago. Most of what has happened since has been merely incremental improvements upon what came before. The true age of innovation, I'll call it the Golden Quarter, ran from approximately 1945 to 1971. Just about everything that defines the modern world either came about or had its seed sown during this time. The pill, electronics, computers and the birth of the internet, nuclear power, television, antibiotics, space travel, civil rights. There is more. Feminism, teenagers, the Green Revolution in agriculture, decolonization, popular music, mass aviation, the birth of the gay rights movement, cheap, reliable, and safe automobiles, high-speed trains. We put a man on the moon, sent a probe to Mars, beat smallpox, and discovered the double spiral key of life. Today, progress is defined almost entirely by consumer-driven, often banal improvements in information technology. Sure, our phones are great, but that's not the same as being able to fly across the Atlantic in 8 hours or eliminating smallpox. As the technologist Peter Thiel once put it, we wanted flying cars. We got 140 characters. But surely progress today is real. Well, take a look around. The airliners you see are basically updated versions of the ones flying in the 1960s. Slightly quieter TriStars with better avionics. In 1971, a regular airliner took 8 hours to fly from London to New York City. It still does. And in 1971, there was one airliner that could do the trip in 3 hours. Now, Concorde is dead. Our cars are faster and safer and use less fuel than they did in 1971, but there has been no paradigm shift. And yes, we are living longer, but this has disappointingly little to do with any recent breakthroughs. Since 1970, the U.S. government has spent more than $100 billion in what President Richard Nixon dubbed the War on Cancer. Far more has been spent globally. Despite these billions of investment, this war has been a spectacular failure. In the U.S., the death rates for all kinds of cancer dropped only 5% in the period 1950 to 2005. The blunt fact is that, with most kinds of cancer, your chances of beating it in 2014 are not much better than they were in 1974. In many cases, your treatment will be pretty much the same. For the past 20 years, as a science writer, I have covered such extraordinary medical advances as gene therapy, cloned replacement organs, stem cell therapy, life extension technologies, the promised spin-offs from genomics and tailored medicine. None of these new treatments is yet routinely available. The paralyzed still cannot walk. The blind cannot see. The human genome was decoded, one post-Golden Quarter triumph, nearly 15 years ago, and we're still waiting to see the benefits that, at the time, were confidently asserted to be a decade away. There has been no new green revolution. We still drive steel cars powered by burning petroleum spirit, or worse, diesel. There has been no new materials revolution since the Golden Quarter's advances in plastics, semiconductors, new alloys, and composite materials. After the dizzying breakthroughs of the early to mid-20th century, physics seems to have ground to a halt. And nobody has been to the moon for 42 years. But why has progress stopped? One explanation is that the Golden Age was the simple result of economic growth and technological spinoffs from the Second World War. It is certainly true that the war sped the development of several weaponizable technologies and medical advances. The Apollo space program probably could not have happened without the aerospace engineer Wernher von Braun and the V-2 ballistic missile. But penicillin, the jet engine, and even the nuclear bomb were on the drawing board before the first shots were fired. They would have happened anyway. Conflict spurs innovation, and the Cold War played its part. We would never have gotten to the moon without it. But someone has to pay for everything. The economic boom came to an end in the 1970s with the collapse of the 1944 Bretton Woods trading agreements and the oil shocks. So did the great age of innovation. Case closed, you might say. And yet something doesn't quite fit. The 1970s recession was temporary. We came out of it soon enough. What's more, in terms of gross world product, the world is 2 to 3 times richer now than it was then. There is more than enough money for a new Apollo, a new Concorde, and a new green revolution. So if rapid economic growth drove innovation in the 1950s and 60s, why has it not done so since? It is possible that the advances we saw in the period 1945 to 1971 were quick wins, and that further progress is much harder. Going from the prop airliners of the 1930s to the jets of the 1960s was, perhaps, just easier than going from today's aircraft to something much better. But history suggests that this explanation is fanciful. During periods of technological and scientific expansion, it has often seemed that a plateau has been reached, only for a new discovery to shatter old paradigms completely. The most famous example was when, in 1900, Lord Kelvin declared physics to be more or less over, just a few years before Einstein proved him comprehensively wrong. Lack of money, then, is not the reason that innovation has stalled. What we do with our money might be, however. Today, wealth is concentrated in the hands of a tiny elite. The richest 1% of humans own half the world's assets. That has consequences. Firstly, there is a lot more for the hyper-rich to spend their money on today than there was in the golden age of philanthropy in the 19th century. The super yachts, fast cars, private jets, and other gigawls of Planet Rich simply did not exist when people such as Andrew Carnegie walked the earth, and though they are no doubt nice to have, these fripperies don't much advance the frontiers of knowledge. As success comes to be defined by the amount of money one can generate in the very short term, progress is defined not by making things better, but by rendering them obsolete as rapidly as possible so that the next iteration of phones, cars, or operating systems can be sold to a willing market. In particular, when share prices are almost entirely dependent on growth, as opposed to market share or profit, built-in obsolescence becomes an important driver of innovation. Half a century ago, markets of telephones, TVs, and cars prospered by building products that their buyers knew, or at least believed, would last for many years. No one sells a smartphone on that basis today. The new ideal is to render your own products obsolete as fast as possible. But there is more to it than inequality and the failure of capital. During the Golden Quarter, we saw a boom in public spending on research and innovation. Nearly all the advances of this period came either from tax-funded universities or from popular movements. The first electronic computers came not from the labs of IBM, but from the universities of Manchester in Pennsylvania. The early internet came out of the University of California, not Bell or Xerox. In short, the great advances in medicine, materials, aviation, and spaceflight were nearly all pump-primed by public investment. But since the 1970s, an assumption has been made that the private sector is the best place to innovate. And yet we cannot pin the stagnation of ingenuity on a decline in public funding. Tax spending on research and development has, in general, increased in real and relative terms in most industrialized nations, even since the end of the Golden Quarter. There must be another reason why this increased investment is not paying more dividends. Could it be that the missing part of the jigsaw is our attitude toward risk? Nothing ventured, nothing gained, as the saying goes. Many of the achievements of the Golden Quarter just wouldn't be attempted now. The assault on smallpox, spearheaded by a worldwide vaccination campaign, probably killed several thousand people, though it saved tens of millions more. In the 1960s, new medicines were rushed to market. Not all of them worked, and a few had disastrous consequences. But the overall result was a medical boom that brought huge benefits to millions. Today, this is impossible. The time for a new drug to gain approval in the U.S. rose from less than 8 years in the 1960s to nearly 13 years by the 1990s. Many promising treatments now take 20 years or more to reach the market. Apollo almost certainly couldn't happen today. That's not because people aren't interested in going to the moon anymore, but because the risk, calculated at a couple of percent chance of astronauts dying, would be unacceptable. Boeing took a huge risk when it developed the 747, an extraordinary 1960s machine that went from drawing board to flight in under 5 years. Its modern equivalent, the Airbus A380, first flew in 2005. 15 years after the project go-ahead. Scientists and technologists were generally celebrated 50 years ago when people remembered what the world was like before penicillin, vaccination, modern dentistry, affordable cars, and TV. Now we are distrustful and suspicious. We have forgotten just how dreadful the world was pre-Golden Quarter. Does any of this really matter? So what if the white heat of technological progress is cooling off a bit? The world is, in general, far safer, healthier, wealthier, and nicer than it has ever been. The recent past was grim. The distant past, disgusting. Levels of violence in most human societies were falling well before the Golden Quarter and have continued to decline since. We are living longer. Civil rights have become so entrenched that gay marriage is being legalized across the world, and any old-style racist thinking is met with widespread revulsion. The world is better in 2014 than it was in 1971. And yes, we have seen some impressive technological advances. The modern internet is a wonder, more impressive in many ways than Apollo. We might have lost Concorde, but you can fly across the Atlantic for a couple of days' wages. Remarkable. Sci-fi visions of the future often had improbable spacecraft and flying cars, but even in Blade Runner's Los Angeles of 2019, Rick Deckard had to use a payphone to call Rachel. But it could have been so much better. If the pace of change had continued, we could be living in a world in which Alzheimer's was treatable, where clean nuclear power had ended the threat of climate change, where the brilliance of genetics was used to bring the benefits of cheap and healthy food to the bottom billion, and where cancer really was on the back foot. Forget colonies on the moon. If the golden quarter had become the golden century, the battery in your magic smartphone might even last more than a day. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Aeon magazine. That's A-E-O-N. On the Health and Science page, the fall of the monarch. Alarmed by a 90% decline in monarch butterfly populations, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is taking steps toward adding the iconic black and orange insects to the official list of endangered species. Monarchs, known for their annual 3,000-mile multi-generational migration across parts of Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, have been in a dramatic decline for the past two decades, falling from a peak of roughly 1 billion in the mid-1990s to just 33 million today. A confluence of factors, including climate change and deforestation, has contributed to the steep decline. But experts say the most catastrophic cause is the widespread use of the industrial-grade herbicide Roundup, which is killing the milkweed plants that provide the monarch's sole source of nourishment. The species is particularly vulnerable because the butterflies winter in tight clusters in the mountains of central Mexico, where predators or bad weather can efficiently wipe out large percentages of the population. A single winter storm in 2002 killed an estimated 500 million monarchs, 15 times the current population. Tierra Curry, a senior scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity, told the Los Angeles Times that an endangered species declaration could be a turning point for the monarch. "These are the butterflies we used to chase through our backyards as kids," she said. "Nobody wants to see them gone." Ebola source revealed. A little boy playing in a tree full of bats may have been the original source of the ongoing Ebola epidemic in West Africa, which has infected more than 20,000 people and killed some 8,100. Researchers recently identified a two-year-old boy named Emile Oumono as the current strain's patient zero. But they were unsure at first how the toddler, who died in December 2013, initially contracted the disease. Previous outbreaks have typically begun in adult patients who probably contracted Ebola by eating contaminated bushmeat. But a team of scientists from the Robert Koch Institute in Germany now reports that Oumono probably caught Ebola while playing in a hollowed-out tree on the outskirts of his village, a tree that was also home to a colony of bats from the species Mops condylurus, mouse-sized mammals that are known to be carriers of the disease. These bats are reportedly targeted by children who regularly hunt and grill them over small fires, lead researcher Fabian Lindertz tells NationalGeographic.com. Ebola is a zoonotic virus that can pass directly from animals to humans, often without making the initial host sick. On the Talking Points page, NYPD. Have cops been unfairly criticized? "So the new year has begun as last year ended," said Thomas Repetto in the New York Post. "With thousands of cops turning their backs on Mayor Bill de Blasio at a funeral for one of their officers. New York City Police Department officers believe the mayor encouraged anti-cop sentiment after a grand jury declined to indict a white cop in the choking death of unarmed black man Eric Garner. De Blasio allied himself with protesters and said he feared for his own biracial son's safety when interacting with cops. Days later, NYPD officers Wenjin Liu and Rafael Ramos were assassinated in Brooklyn by a vigilante who wrote on social media, "I'm putting wings on pigs today. They take one of ours. Let's take two of theirs." As police union leader Patrick Lynch rightly put it, said Lee Harib in NationalReview.com, "There's blood on many hands." In recent months, Mayor de Blasio, Attorney General Eric Holder, and President Obama have all joined protesters in peddling the dreadful lie that black people in America should fear the police. NYPD officers are mad as hell and have begun a defiant work slowdown in which the enforcement of petty offenses is down more than 90%. "It is absurd to have to say this," said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, "but only one person is responsible for the killings of Officer Liu and Ramos. A mentally ill career criminal named Ismael Brinsley, who earlier that day shot his ex-girlfriend and later killed himself. Don't blame his insane actions on protesters who objected to Garner's needless and unpunished death. Hating perceived injustice is not the same as hating the police." To understand why protesters are angry, said Charles Blow in the New York Times, consider a December case from Chattanooga, Tennessee. There, an angry nut in body armor allegedly fired multiple shots out of her car window at people and other cars. She even pointed her gun at a cop. Yet after a police chase, Julia Shields, a 45-year-old white woman, was taken into custody unharmed. Not so Eric Garner, or the unarmed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, or 12-year-old Tamir Rice, killed by cops while holding a toy gun in a Cleveland playground. All ended up dead in seconds. And police insist we have no right to believe there is a double standard in the use of force by police. "It's long past time for a little perspective," said John Poritz in New York Post. "So here it is. Cops rarely kill. The NYPD has 34,500 officers. Every morning, these men and women say goodbye to their families and go out into the streets to protect the city's 8 million residents. They have an estimated 25 million interactions with civilians annually. Yet in all of 2014, three people died during some form of confrontation with NYPD officers. In the meantime, these hardworking cops have transformed New York City into one of the nation's safest big cities," said Peter Werner in CommentaryMagazine.com. "Overall crime has dropped nearly 80%, and nowhere is that progress more noticeable than in the very low-income and minority neighborhoods whose residents are supposedly targeted by police. That doesn't excuse the NYPD's shocking insubordination," said Connor Friedersdorf in TheAtlantic.com. "When public employees contemptuously turn their backs on the mayor while engaging in a defiant slowdown in law enforcement, they are making a threat. Stop complaining when black citizens are roughed up or killed, or risk an armed, organized army rebelling against civilian control. As painful as it is to take the side of Bill de Blasio," said Leon Wolf in RedState.com, "the NYPD is behaving appallingly. Union leaders are encouraging cops to believe that they alone among public employees are entitled to stop doing their jobs because they have faced the horrible indignity of being publicly criticized." "The cop slowdown is certainly one of the more confusing political protests in recent memory," said Matt Taibbi in RollingStone.com. "By refusing to arrest or issue summons for petty crimes like carrying an open beer or parking illegally, these cops are undermining the very broken windows policies that so infuriate residents of so-called hotspot neighborhoods. Cash-strapped residents are no longer being forced to hand over a day's wages and fines, while cops aren't wasting their time filling predetermined summons quotas. This new approach to law enforcement should be a cause for celebration. Instead, it's just more fodder for our ongoing hate-a-thon. Happy New Year, America. And we have time for some short notes. 50 police officers were shot and killed in the line of duty in 2014, a big increase from 2013 when 32 were slain. In general, however, policing is becoming safer. From 1970 to 1979, an average of 127 officers were killed each year, and that figure has steadily declined over the past three decades. More than 76,000 people died in Syria's civil war in 2014, including more than 3,500 children, according to the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights. More than 206,000 people have now died in the conflict. Russian President Vladimir Putin was the 10th most admired man in America in 2014, according to Gallup's annual survey, coming in ahead of Mitt Romney, Joe Biden, and Bono. Barack Obama topped the list of most admired, followed by Pope Francis, Bill Clinton, and the Reverend Billy Graham. A whopping 83.5% of the 1,000 Rome police officers who were scheduled to work on New Year's Eve ended up calling in sick that night. Some officers used the excuse that they had donated blood, while others said they were suffering from disabilities. The new Congress is 80% white, 80% male, and 92% Christian. That makes it one of the most diverse in history. Although 20% of the public has no religious affiliation, only 0.2% of Congress claims to be in that category. And a quote for you from Diane von Furstenberg, quoted in HarperBazaar.com. My face carries all of my memories. Why would I erase them? We've run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.